Hello, friends and neighbors. A hearty welcome aboard. Right next to me, Bob Zanotti. And, Bob, I think we have a mystery guest somewhere.
Well, we have to clarify that, Bob, when you say right next to me, only electronically, because as a matter of fact, you and I are separated by about 10 miles, something like that. And I am sitting in the Emmental. You are sitting north of the city of Bern. And we are linked together by Skype, which we have demonstrated here, also on the Two Bobs section of Switzerland in Sound. And you're coming through loud and clear. But we have someone else. Today it's the Two Bobs plus one. Will that mystery guest please reveal his identity?
Well, maybe I should just say hello and let people try and recognize the voice.
And it's the voice of Ian McFarland. Formerly of Radio Canada International, retired.
And
Radio Japan, exactly. And Ian, now you living out on the west coast of Canada. You're in a beautiful spot in British Columbia, not too far from Vancouver, Victoria. Is that correct?
That's right, Bob. We're on Vancouver Island, on the east side of Vancouver Island. It's about an hour's drive north of Victoria, which is the provincial capital of British Columbia. And we're right on an ocean bay, and we look out across the water to the largest of the what are known as the Gulf Islands, and that's Salt Spring Island.
How many years have you been retired from RCI now?
Well, since 1991, but of course, about 3 days after the big disaster hit on the 25th of March, 1991, I escaped Canada and went to Tokyo and ended up working at Radio Japan, NHK, for 2 years, and then came back to Montreal, where we still had a house. And I didn't go back to RCI because that part of my career was over. Because, as it turned out, with all the budget cuts and the personnel cuts and program cuts, there wasn't really anything for me to go back to. None of the programs that I'd spent the last 20 to 24 years producing and hosting existed anymore, because all of RCI's output, virtually all of it, existed as a replay of what was on the English CBC network here in Canada.
Ian, really, how did you get into international broadcasting?
It was a very deliberate act on my part, because back in the late 50s, I was going to technical college, learning electronics, because I wanted to get into the CBC, into CBC Radio. That's the domestic radio in Montreal. So I graduated and ended up by a sheer fluke. Every time I wrote to the technical director of radio asking if they had any openings for me, the answer was no. And then that lasted for about 6 months. And then I just took a chance. I wrote all my letters of application in English, being a stubborn Anglophone in Montreal. And so I decided, well, I'll write the next one in French. So I wrote the next one in French, and about 4 days later, I had a phone call at 10 o'clock on a Friday night from the technical director of radio himself, asking if I was available to fill in for somebody for 6 months. Somebody had gone out on a remote assignment and fell off a shed and broke his back.
Oh.
So that is the way I got into CBC Radio.
So you are the father. You are the father, so to speak, of the DX Digest.
Well, it started off in a very humble way, actually. About 2 years after the old Radio Canada Shortwave Club, which was a very, very popular program around the world. In all of RCI's target areas, there was a two-year period between when that went off the air and the DX Digest started. And the head of the German section, who was doing a few other things within RCI, or the international service as it was in those days, asked me if, because I was the producer of the Radio Canada Shortwave Club for the last, I guess, 4 or 5 years of its existence. And he asked me if I thought I could put together a little 5-minute DX feature that would go into the weekend programming. So I tried not to sound too enthusiastic, because I figured if I'm too enthusiastic, they'll do away with the whole idea. So I said, yeah, I think I can put together a 5-minute feature. So the first week I put together a 5-minute feature, and it slowly crept up. The second or third week it was 5.5 or 6 minutes, and then it went up to 7 minutes. And then ultimately, if I recall correctly, and this is going back an awful long time, it was up to 10 minutes. So it was doing very well. It was very popular, and eventually...
Now, you were writing this in English, and they were translating it into German.
I can't remember whether they translated it or whether they did their own DX feature. I have a
based on your information.
Possibly, yeah. Yeah. My memory is a little hazy on that one. But
I got to catch you on a point of order here, Ian. I don't want you to lose your train of thought, but I'm curious about one thing. A fundamental question about Ian McFarland and communications programs. What was your own personal interest? Why did they come to Ian McFarland for a communications magazine? You obviously must have been interested in this personally.
Well, I was. I had a technical background. I had been a technician. Maybe I should fill in a little of the background here. I started off in 1959 as a studio technician, and worked for 3.5 years. And, of course, most of that time was either opening up the local CBC station in Montreal at 5:30 in the morning, or closing it down at 1:15 in the morning. So eventually the DX Digest, which was started off, as I said, with a little 5-minute feature, sort of crept up, and nobody said keep it to 5 minutes. So when nobody's holding you back, you keep on going. So eventually it ended up being 22 or 22 and a half, 23 minutes on its own on one of the transmissions. And eventually it was heard on all of the target area services, which had English programs. So it had its humble beginnings, but it blossomed. And, of course, since I had an interest in technology and had a technical background, I was the ideal producer for it, I guess, because none of the other producers had any technical background at all. But I should mention, going back a few years, when I left the CBC in 1963 and went to England, I had planned to work for the BBC. But that didn't quite work out for a number of reasons, and I ended up working in the CBC's London Bureau, which was the hub of the whole European news operation, and ended up in a job called production assistant. But since there were no unions to control things, I did virtually every aspect of broadcasting. So I got what amounted to a total journeyman's education in broadcasting, mm-hmm. and it has served me well for all of my working life.
Ian, June 1994, it was with distress and sadness we saw the Swiss shortwave medical go down the drain. And this may just as well have been the beginning of the decay of international broadcasting altogether. What is your view? What happened to international broadcasting and, well, perhaps its meager survival?
The whole idea of international broadcasting, I think, has changed drastically, because so many people these days are equipped with computers, and virtually every international broadcaster, or the vast majority of them, have a website where you can tap into any of their programs with virtual line quality. You don't have to worry about battling shortwave interference. So a lot of people are getting their shortwave listening done that way. There are, of course, still the dyed-in-the-wool DXers that enjoy the challenge of picking up stations on the shortwave bands. But these days there are so many stations that have disappeared. And I've always been of the opinion, a lot of our listeners may have heard of that great communications guru from Canada, Marshall McLuhan, who died a few years ago, but he always maintained that the medium was the message. But I don't think there were more than two people in the world, one of whom was Marshall McLuhan himself, that really understood what he meant by that.
Absolutely.
And I always maintained that it wasn't the medium that was the message, it was the message that was the message.
Well, and this is a phrase we both agree on, Ian. We've, even in Culpsville, we said the same thing. I mean, I don't know where the man got this idea from, and I think it was taken out of context, but I can only confirm and affirm what you're saying. The message is the message, and we mustn't get lost in technology. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, it doesn't matter whether somebody is listening to Radio Moscow on their computer or doing it on a shortwave radio. They're getting the message that Radio Moscow, or any other station for that matter, wants to put out to the rest of the world.
On the other hand, if you're a traveler, if you're out in the middle of Jibib somewhere, and you have no internet, you have no computer, you have no satellite, then all of a sudden shortwave becomes important again.
Oh, yeah. The shortwave never really lost its importance. It just was not quite as present around the world. In places like North America, Canada, the United States, Western Europe, so many people have computers these days at home. They don't need to rely on their shortwave radios to hear international broadcasting. They just tune it in on their computer. But, of course, as you say, when you travel, you don't have access to the internet for most of the time, but even that is changing with wireless technology. You can take your laptop to almost any place in a big city and you'll find a hotspot where you can link up to the internet on your laptop. So even that aspect of it is changing. In 10 years from now, you'll be able to link up to the internet no matter where in the world you are, thanks to satellites perhaps.
Yeah, that's right. But another point I would like to put the fingers on is the, you know, in the fascination, when we started out youngsters, was crystal detectors and later on twiddling the knobs and shortwave, the fascination of picking stations out of the noise, the technicalities of the physical facts and figures, okay. These are gone, obviously. They have, with a computer, you click it on, you choose your program. But this fascination we used to know as kids, this has definitely gone. Do you think there will be a sort of a revival of this euphoria?
I don't know. There is still a large community of dyed-in-the-wool, what we call DXers, who enjoy the challenge of trying to pick up especially weak stations or one that's half buried under somebody that's using 500 kilowatts or half a megawatt. That's where the challenge comes in. The fun of shortwave listening is not specifically to get information from a given country, but to just see what is out there on the bands to be heard. And I think that'll always... that'll always be there amongst, I suppose, perhaps a smaller and smaller as the years go on community. But you can tell from the shortwave listeners' clubs, the DX clubs, not related to a given station, but these are going by the wayside increasingly these years. The membership dwindles, and it's just not an economic proposition to keep them going. And even the Ontario DX Association, which is probably the biggest and best of the listeners' clubs here in Canada, is experiencing a reduction in the size of their membership. And they've had to alter the way they do their monthly bulletin, and it's not in the form of a booklet anymore. It's just photocopies of the pages. So... It is dwindling, and there are fewer and fewer clubs as the years go by. But it'll always be a hobby for a lot of people, and I think that's a good thing.
You know, I'm just sitting here going back in history a little bit mentally, and when you're talking about the grand old days and everything else, I just was thinking to myself, when was the first time that the three of us got together? And I believe, and also in the connection of North American DXing or SWLing, mentioned the Ontario DX Association still around, but an organization which used to be the umbrella organization, which is unfortunately no longer with us, ANARC, Association of North American Radio Clubs. Wasn't it Mississauga outside Toronto back in the 80s when the three of us first got together?
It may very well be, because the ODXA organized, I think, two or three of the ANARC conventions, and I know a couple of them were in the 1980s. I organized three of them, I think, in the 70s and 80s.
Montreal was one, which you personally organized, yeah.
Yeah, the first one that I organized on behalf of RCI was in 1978, and that's the first time we had any broadcasters taking an active part.
I was there. Bob Tolman was not on hand, but you and I got together then, yeah.
And that really was the genesis of an offshoot of that, which was the International Broadcasters Get-Togethers.
Right.
I started that off. The basis of the idea happened in 1978, where we got a few broadcasters, but then it sort of blossomed, and for a day ahead of the ANARC convention, we had an actual broadcasters get-together where we could talk about our common problems, and I know a lot of people discovered that they weren't the only one that had problems with management or problems with this and that, and it was really great for us to get together, because we had never had a chance to get together and discuss common concerns. And these organized meetings went on for, I guess probably close to 10 years.
Yeah, you refreshed a memory there, the broadcasters' meetings. A very interesting and very useful addition to the sort of a sidebar to those DXer get-togethers. That's right.
Yeah.
And you and I also got together in Sweden. I think Bob, you were in Sweden. We were, was it Gothenburg?
Gothenburg or Gothenburg, yes.
Yeah, Gothenburg in English, right.
I think the first one that I went to was in 1974, and if I remember correctly, that was the one that was held in Malmö, down on the southern tip of Sweden.
Or Malmö, yeah. Right.
And actually, in my archives, in my filing cabinets, I still have a picture of you, Bob Zanotti, and me sitting at a picnic bench recording an interview. And that was the first time that you and I had bumped into each other. It was the first time I had gone to Europe, first of many trips, I'm happy to say, that have many, many nice memories attached to them.
Yeah.
But that was the first time that we had met each other, and I don't know. I guess we just happened to hit it off together, and the friendship and the cooperation carried on for decades.
We did very, very little sleeping and a great deal of talking at these events.
Yes, I can remember, and I can't remember the locale, but you and I, over a bottle of red wine and some tortilla chips, talked the evening through, and by the time we discovered what time it was 5 o'clock in the morning. And
only one bottle of wine, Ian?
Well, we started with one. It might have been a couple of bottles.
I think that's a euphemism over a bottle of wine, yeah.
But that memory sticks in my mind, and it's hard to believe that we just talked and talked and talked right through the night, and then to look alert the next day for the various seminars that we were involved with.
That was pure professionalism that carried us through.
Yes, toothpicks to keep the eyes open.
Well, I remember when once Ian and, was it Michael Murray? I don't know. The few of us were producing a program which was sent over SRI and CBC at the same time. We did a joint programming there. I don't know for war. The reason was, I think there was a strike in Canada. You remember that incident, Ian?
you jogged a memory there. I think at one point when I was in Europe on one occasion, there was a strike at the CBC, which made it difficult for RCI to continue with broadcasts. I think they were running tapes from the transmitter site. In addition to doing that, we did a lot of joint programs. I know that at the huge ITU exhibition that happens in Geneva every 4 years, the one
Telecom.
I went to was in 1983, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
And we did some joint programming on that. We recorded a lot of stuff together, and then we split it up, and some of it was on my Shortwave Listener's Digest program, and some of it was on the Swiss Shortwave Merry-Go-Round.
So we used to end each other, our respective programs, saying, well, this is the SRI coverage for part two of the coverage of Telecom 83, for example, or this DX meeting. Tune in this weekend to the SWL Digest on RCI. I mean, nobody had cooperation like that. That was unique.
No, it was truly unique, and it was only the listener that benefited, because they were getting twice as much coverage of an extremely interesting exhibition, the ITU Telecom 83 exhibition. And I'd only wish that I could have done a couple more, but I think 1983 was the one and only that I was able to get to.
Oh, but we had some great fun. I remember down in the basement cutting room.
Yes.
It was not the favorite cutting room at SRI, but we loved it. You know, I go down the street to the supermarket, got a couple of frozen pizzas and a bottle of wine. We'd go down there. We'd have a nonstop cutting session. We'd have our pizzas, have some wine. I mean, this is the way we did radio. I mean, this today, if you see, you tell this to people today, they look at you sort of cross-eyed, you know. But this is the way we worked, and we did good radio. You know,
yeah,
Bob, you were in on it. You know, we're talking about the old days, the glorious days of radio at Swiss Radio International, also other radio stations. I mean, people who worked in international broadcasting, Bob, as you well know, and you were a pioneer. You were there many years before I was. I mean, this was a dedication. This was something you had in your blood.
Well, what shall I say? Tears get in my eye. I started also as a shortwave listener later. In 1946, I became a radio ham, and this, of course, kindled the interest in communication via shortwaves, and that's how the whole story began.
Yeah, it was a tight family. We all knew each other. Jonathan Marks and Andy Sennett, remember? The World Radio TV Handbook, Jens Frost, Michael Murray, who's still around.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. There are still a few of us around, and we have very, very fond memories.
Ian, I understand you're editing and compiling a whole lot of signal stations and stations from Lord knows how many radio stations around the world. An interesting question. Where do you get all the information from?
Well, Bob, this is a feature that was played on the program, my Shortwave Listener's Digest program, back in the mid-70s. And it was called the Shortwave Listener's Digest Ident and Interval Signals Series. And there were something like 160 different identification signals and identification announcements. And that represented 160 different shortwave stations or shortwave outlets. And that was one of the most popular features that we ever had on the program. And many years ago, when the Handicapped Aid program was in operation, a lot of listeners whose listening goes back three or four decades will remember the Handicapped Aid program that operated in Canada and Britain and Europe and North America generally. And I put this series on three cassettes, and it was sold as a fundraising project for the Handicapped Aid program. But HAP, as it was known for short, ceased to operate many years ago now. So it occurred to me about a year ago that There are probably a lot of listeners, the younger listeners, who haven't been listening since the mid-70s, who would not have heard this very interesting and somewhat historic now series. So I decided to update the technology a bit, and we've put it on two CDs. The first one covers Europe and part of Africa, and the second CD covers the second half of Africa, plus Asia, the Pacific, the Americas, the Caribbean, and the rest of the world, basically. So that's available for sale. And there is a website where you can download an order form for it. It's on a website called dxer.ca. And that'll give you all the information. I won't take the time to go into all of it at the moment. But
well, we'll put up a link here, Ian.
Yeah, the price is very reasonable. For anyone in Canada, it's $10. For the U.S., it's $10 U.S. And for the rest of the world, it's $15.
I think that's too cheap. You ought to triple the prices. you're obviously of the old school, Ian.
Oh yes, sir. Trying to give listeners a bargain and nostalgia, and for some people who aren't familiar with the series, it'll give them something interesting to listen to. Because, of course, a lot of the stations that whose idents and interval signals are heard in this series are no longer on the air.
This is a precious sound document. Interval signals, identification signals, vintage signals going back, well, Ian, we're talking nearly 40 years, right?
Yes, yeah. And there are about 16 ident signals and ident announcements from stations in the USSR, just to...
which do not exist anymore.
A lot of them don't. There's Radio Mayak, there's Radio Kiev, Radio Stancia Atlantica, Radio Ashgabad in the Turkmenian SSR, Radio Dushanbe in Tajikistan, mm-hmm. Radio Petrozavodsk, and it goes on. You know, Radio Frunze, I'm not sure exactly how many of these stations are still on the air, but I'm sure a few of them aren't.
And it also is for a charitable purpose, Ian, which is very important.
Yes, Bob, it is. The net profits from this, which are not going to be huge, I'm sure, but one of my activities in retirement is volunteering with a local food bank in my area, and it's a food bank and a soup kitchen, and that takes a lot of money to run, and it's supported by public donations, basically. I'm giving the net profits to that organization, so that'll help a lot of people.
Bob, I miss one item in Ian's collection there. That's the two Bobs in concert.
Oh, well, I don't think there's a great demand for that. and you can find that right here on the website.
You mentioned that the set of two CDs was highly underpriced. I should say that if anybody wants to pay double that price, all of that extra money will go to the
food
bank.
You'll take it.
We'll take it, and it'll go to a good cause.
Well, I think that this discussion, this three-way discussion we've had, gentlemen, this Skype conference call, not only is typical of what we're devoted to, communication and technology, but it also proves that the three of us are still alive and well and kicking.
Oh, yes.
We got our projects going on.
It's been really great having this chat. And
I hear you got a European trip coming up, and we're looking forward to greeting you here in the Emmental.
That's in the planning stage at the moment, and we would look forward to seeing you in your home once again.
Well, we'll have to get together. Bob will have to come up, and hopefully with Evelyn, his wife, his XYL, and we'll get the wood-burning pizza oven fired up and bring a couple of cases of red wine in.
Oh, that'll be worth the trip just on its own.
Okay, we'll do some of those the old all-night get-together sessions there. Bob, you are the senior. It falls upon you to close out this three-way edition.
Yeah, okay, Ian, it's been a pleasure to hear you again. So until we meet again next time, this is yours truly, Bob Tomlin, and
Bob Zanotti.
saying goodbye.
Good DXing.
Very best of 73s.